Side 4. The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch by Philip K. Dick. Continuing on page 120. In the corner of the living room of his Conap rested the suitcase containing Dr. Smile. He switched it on and said, "Doctor, you'll have a bit of trouble believing this, but I have no further need of your services. Goodbye and good luck," as the girl who isn't going said. He added by way of explanation, "I volunteered." "Cedric!" Dr. Smile blared, slipping a cog down below in the Conapt building's basement. "But for your type, that's virtually impossible. What was the reason, Mr. Meyerson?" "The death wish," he said, and shut the psychiatrist off. He resumed his packing in silence. God, he thought. And a little while ago, Ronnie and I had such big plans. We were going to sell out Leo on a grand scale, go over to Eldritch with an enormous splash. What happened to all that? "I'll tell you what happened," he said to himself. "Leo acted first. And now Ronnie has my job, exactly what she wanted." The more he thought of it, the angrier it made him, in a baffled sort of way. But there was nothing he could do about it, at least not in this world. Maybe when he chewed candy or choosy, he could inhabit a universe where... There was a knock at the door. "Hi," Leo said. "Can I come in?" He entered the apt, wiping his immense forehead with a folded handkerchief. "Hot day. I looked in the paper and it's gone up 6/10 of..." "If you came to offer me my job back," Barney said, pausing in his packing, "it's too late, because I've entered the service. I'm leaving tomorrow for the Feinberg Crescent." It would be a final irony if Leo wanted to make peace, the ultimate turn of the blind wheels of creation. "I'm not offering you your job back, and I know you've been inducted. I've got informants in the Selective Service, and anyhow, Dr. Smile notified me. I was paying him, you didn't know this, of course, to report to me on your progress in declining under stress." "What do you want, then?" Leo said, "I want you to accept a job with Felix Blau. It's all worked out." "The rest of my life," Barney said quietly, "will be spent at Feinberg Crescent. Don't you understand?" "Take it easy. I'm trying to make the best of a bad situation, and you'd better, too. Both of us acted too hastily. Me in firing you, you in giving yourself up to your Dracula-type Selective Service Board. Barney, I think I know a way to ensnare Palmer Eldritch. I've hashed it out with Blau, and he likes the idea. You're to pose as a colonist," Leo corrected himself. "Or rather, go ahead. Live your actual colonist-type life. Become one of the group. Now, one of these days, probably in the next week, Eldritch is going to start peddling choosy in your area. They may right away approach you. Anyhow, we hope so. We're counting on it." Barney rose to his feet. "And I'm supposed to jump to and buy?" "Right. Why?" "You file a complaint. Our legal boys will draw it up for you with the UN, declaring that the goddamn miserable unholy crap produced highly toxic side effects in you. Never mind what, now. We'll escalate you into a test case. Compel the UN to ban Choosy as harmful, dangerous. We'll keep it off Terra completely. Actually, it's ideal, you quitting your job with PP and going into the service. It couldn't have happened at a better time." Barney shook his head. "What's that mean?" Leo said. "I'm out of it." "Why?" Barney shrugged. Actually, he did not know. "After the way I let you down..." "You panicked. You didn't know what to do. It's not your job. I should have had Smile contact the head of our company police, John Seltzer." "All right, so you made a mistake. It's over." "No," Barney said. "Because," he thought, "of what I learned from it about myself. I can't forget that. Those insights, they only go one way, and that's straight at your heart. And they're poison-filled." "Don't brood, for Christ's sakes. I mean, it's morbid. You still have a whole lifetime ahead, even if it is at Feinberg Crescent. I mean, You'd probably have been drafted anyhow, right? You agree? Agitated, Leo paced about the living room.
What a mess. All right, don't help us out. Let Eldritch and those proxies do whatever it is they're up to, taking over the Sol system, or even worse, the entire universe, starting with us.
He halted, glared at Barney. Let me think it over. Wait till you take Choosy. You'll find out. It's going to contaminate us all, starting inside and working to the surface. It's utter derangement. Wheezing with exertion, Leo paused to cough violently.
Too many cigars, he said weakly. Geez.
He eyed Barney. The guy's given me a day, you know that? I'm supposed to capitulate, and if not... He snapped his fingers. I can't be on Mars that soon, Barney said, let alone be set up to buy a bindle of Choosy from a pusher.
I know that, Leo's voice was hard, but he can't destroy me that soon. It'll take him weeks, maybe even months. And by then, we'll have someone in the courts who can show damages. I recognize this doesn't sound to you like much, but...
Barney said, contact me when I'm on Mars, at my hovel.
I'll do that. I'll do that.
And then, half to himself, Leo said,
and it'll give you a reason.
Pardon?
Nothing, Barney.
Explain. Leo shrugged.
Hell, I know the spot you're in. Ronnie's got your job. You were right. And I had you traced. I know you went beeline-wise to your ex. You still love her, and she won't come with you, will she? I know you better than you know yourself. I know exactly why you didn't show up to bail me out when Palmer had me. Your whole life has led up to your replacing me, and now that's collapsed. You have to start over with something new. Too bad, but you did it to yourself by overreaching. See, I don't plan to step aside, never did. You're good, but not as an executive, only as pre-fash boy. You're too petty. Look at how you turned down those pots of Richard Natts. That was a dead giveaway, Barney. I'm sorry.
Okay, Barney said finally. Possibly you're right.
Well, so you learned a lot about yourself. And you can start again, Feinberg Crescent-wise.
Leo slapped him on the back.
Become a leader in your hovel. Make it creative and productive, or whatever hovels do. And you'll be a spy for Felix Blau. That's big time.
Barney said, I could have gone over to Eldritch.
Yeah, but you didn't. Who cares what you might have done?
You think I did the right thing to volunteer for the service? Leo said quietly, Stella, what the hell else could you do? There was no answer to that, and they both knew it. When the urge strikes you, Leo said, to feel sorry for yourself, remember this. Palmer Eldritch wants to kill me. I'm a lot worse off than you. I guess so. It rang true, and he had one more intuition to accompany that. His situation would become the same as Leo's the moment he initiated litigation against Palmer Eldritch. He did not look forward to it. That night he found himself on a UN transport sighted on the planet Mars as its destination. In the seat next to him sat a pretty, frightened but desperately calm, dark-haired girl with features as sharply etched as those of a magazine model. Her name, she told him, almost as soon as the ship had attained escape velocity, she was patently eager to break her tension by conversation with anyone on any topic, was Anne Hawthorne. She could have avoided the draft, she declared a trifle wistfully, but she hadn't. She believed it to be her patriotic duty to accept the chilling UN greetings summons. How would you have avoided it? He asked, curious.
A heart murmur, Anne said. And an arrhythmia, paroxysmal tachycardia.
How about premature contractions, such as auricular, nodal, and ventricular, auricular tachycardia, auricular flutter, auricular fibrillation, not to mention night cramps? Barney asked, having himself looked, without result, into the topic.
I could have produced documents from hospitals and doctors and insurance companies testifying for me.
She glanced him over, up and down, then, very interestedly,
it sounds as if you could have gotten out, Mr. Pierson.
Meyerson. I volunteered, Miss Hawthorne. But I couldn't have gotten out. Not for long, he said to himself. They're very religious in the colonies. So I hear, anyhow. What denomination are you, Mr. Meyerson? He said, stuck. I think you'd better find out before we get there. They'll ask you and expect you to attend services. She added, it's primarily the use of that drug, you know, candy. It's brought about a lot of conversions to the established churches, although many of the colonists find in the drug itself a religious experience that's adequate for them. I have relatives on Mars. They write me, so I know. I'm going to the Feinberg Crescent. Where are you going? Up the creek, he thought. The same, he said aloud. Possibly you and I'll be in the same hovel, Anne Hawthorne said, with a thoughtful expression on her precisely cut face. I belong to the Reformed branch of the Neo-American Church, the New Christian Church of the United States and Canada. Actually, our roots are very old. In A.D. 300, our forefathers had bishops that attended a conference in France. We didn't split off from the other churches as late as everyone thinks. So you can see we have apostolic succession. She smiled at him in a solemn, friendly fashion. Honest, Barney said, I believe it, whatever that is. There's a Neo-American mission church in the Feinberg Crescent, and therefore a vicar, a priest. I expect to be able to take Holy Communion at least once a month, and confess twice a year as we're supposed to, as I've been doing on Terra. Our church has many sacraments. Have you taken either of the two greater sacraments, Mr. Meyerson? He hesitated. Christ specified that we observe two sacraments, Anne Hawthorne explained patiently. Baptism by water and Holy Communion. The latter in memory of him, it was inaugurated at the Last Supper. Oh, you mean the bread and the wine. You know how the eating of candy translates, as they call it, the partaker to another world. It's secular, however, in that it's temporary and only a physical world. The bread and the wine... I'm sorry, Miss Hawthorne, Barney said, but I'm afraid I can't believe in that, the body and blood business. It's too mystical for me. Too much based upon unproved premises, he said to himself. But she was right. Sacral religion had, because of Candy, become common in the colony moons and planets, and he would be encountering it, as Anne said. Are you going to try Candy? Anne said. Sure. Anne said, you have faith in that, and yet you know that the earth it takes you to isn't the real one. I don't want to argue it, he said. It's experienced as real. That's all I know. So are dreams. But this is stronger, he pointed out, clearer. And it's done in... He had started to say communion. In company with others who really go along. So it can't be entirely an illusion. Dreams are private. That's the reason we identify them as illusion. But Perky Pat... It would be interesting to know what the people who make the Perky Pat layouts think about it all, Anne said reflectively. I can tell you. To them, it's just a business. As probably the manufacturer of sacramental wine and wafers is to those who... If you're going to try Candy, Anne said, and put your faith for a new life into it, can I induce you to try baptism and confirmation into the Neo-American Christian Church? So you could see if your faith deserves to be put into that, too. Or the First Revised Christian Church of Europe, which of course also observes the two greater sacraments. Once you've participated in Holy Communion, I can't, he said. I believe in Candy, he said to himself, and if necessary, choosy. You can put your faith in something 21 centuries old. I'll stick with something new, and that is that. Anne said, To be frank, Mr. Meyerson, I intend to try to convert as many colonists as possible away from Candy to the traditional Christian practices. That's the central reason I declined to put together a case that would exempt me from the draft. She smiled at him, a lovely smile which, in spite of himself, warmed him. Is that wrong? I'll tell you frankly. I think the use of candy indicates a genuine hunger on the part of these people to find a return to what we in the Neo-American Church, I think, Barney said gently. You should let these people alone. And me too, he thought. I've got enough troubles as it is. Don't add your religious fanaticism and make it worse. But she did not look like his idea of a religious fanatic, nor did she talk like one. He was puzzled. Where had she gotten such strong, steady convictions? He could imagine it existing in the colonies where the need was so great, but she had acquired it on Earth. Therefore, the existence of Can D, the experience of group translation, did not fully explain it. Maybe, he thought, it's been the transition by gradual stages of Earth to the hell-like blasted wasteland which all of them could foresee. Hell, experience, that had done it. The hope of another life on different terms had been reawakened. Myself, he thought, the individual I've been, Barney Meyerson of Earth, who worked for PP Layouts and lived in the renowned Connaught building with the unlikely low number 33, is dead. That person is finished, wiped out as if by a sponge. Whether I like it or not, I've been born again. Being a colonist on Mars, he said, isn't going to be like living on Terra. Maybe when I get there... He ceased. He had intended to say, maybe I'll be more interested in your dogmatic church. But as yet, he could not honestly say that, even as a conjecture. He rebelled from an idea that was still foreign to his makeup. And yet... Go ahead, Anne Hawthorne said. Finish your sentence. Talk to me again, Barney said, when I've lived down in the bottom of a hovel on an alien world for a while. When I've begun my new life, if you can call it a life, as a colonist. His tone was bitter. It surprised him, the ferocity. It bordered on being anguish, he realized with shame. Anne said placidly, All right, I'll be glad to. After that, the two of them sat in silence. Barney read a homeopape, and beside him, Anne Hawthorne, the fanatic girl missionary to Mars, read a book. He peered at the title and saw that it was Eric Lederman's great text on colonial living, Pilgrim Without Progress. God knew where she had gotten a copy. The UN had condemned it, made it incredibly difficult to obtain. And to read a copy of it here, on a UN ship, it was a singular act of courage. He was impressed. Glancing at her, he realized that she was really overwhelmingly attractive to him. Except that she was just a little too thin, wore no makeup, and had as much of her heavy, dark hair as possible covered with a round, white, veil-like cap. She looked, he decided, as if she were dressed for a long journey which would end in church. Anyhow, he liked her manner of speaking, her compassionate, modulated voice. Would he run into her again on Mars? It came to him that he hoped so. In fact, was this improper? He hoped even to find himself participating with her in the corporate act of taking candy. Yes, he thought, it's improper because I know what I intend, what the experience of translation with her would signify to me. He hoped it anyhow. 8. Extending his hand, Norm Shine said heartily, Hi there, Meyerson. I'm the official greeter from our hovel. Welcome, to Mars.
I'm Fran Shine, his wife said, also shaking hands with Barney Meyerson.
We have a very orderly, stable hovel here. I don't think you'll find it too dreadful. She added, half to herself, just dreadful enough. She smiled, but Meyerson did not smile back. He looked grim, tired, and depressed, as most new colonists did on arrival to a life which they knew was difficult and essentially meaningless. Don't expect us to sell you on the virtues of this, she said. That's the UN's job. We're nothing more than victims like yourself, except that we've been here a while. Don't make it sound so bad, Norm said in warning. But it is, Fran said. Mr. Meyerson is facing it. He isn't going to accept any pretty story, right, Mr. Meyerson?
I could do with a little illusion at this point, Barney said as he seated himself on a metal bench within the hovel entrance. The sand plow which had brought him, meanwhile, unloaded his gear. He watched dully.
Sorry, Fran said. Okay to smoke?
Barney got out a package of Terran cigarettes. The Shine stared at them fixedly, and he then offered them each a chance at the pack, guiltily.
You arrived at a difficult time, Norm Shine explained. We're right in the middle of a debate.
He glanced around at the others.
Since you're now a member of our hovel, I don't see why you shouldn't be brought into it. After all, it concerns you, too.
Todd Morris said, maybe he'll, you know, tell.
We can swear him to secrecy, Sam Regan said, and his wife Mary nodded. Our discussion, Mr. Geyerson,
Meyerson, Barney corrected,
has to do with the drug Can-D, which is the old reliable translating agent we've depended on, versus the newer, untried drug Choosy. We're debating whether to drop Can-D once and for all and
wait until we're below, Norm Shine said and scowled.
Seating himself on a bench beside Barney Meyerson, Todd Morris said, Can-D is kaput. It's too hard to get, costs too many skins, and personally I'm tired of Perky Pat. It's too artificial, too superficial, and materialistality in... Pardon, that's our word here for... He groped in difficult explanation.
Well, it's apartments, cars, sunbathing on the beach, ritzy clothes. We enjoyed it for a while, but it's not enough in some sort of unmaterialistality way.
You see it all, Meyerson?
Norm Shine said, okay. But Meyerson here hasn't had that. He isn't jaded. Maybe he'd appreciate going through all that.
Like we did, Fran agreed. Anyhow, we haven't voted. We haven't decided which we're going to buy and use from now on. I think we ought to let Mr. Meyerson try both. Or have you already tried Can-D, Mr. Meyerson?
I did, Barney said. But a long time ago. Too long for me to remember clearly.
Leo had given it to him and offered him more, big amounts, all he wanted. But he had declined. It hadn't appealed to him.
Norm Shine said, This is rather an unfortunate welcome to our hovel, I'm afraid, getting you embroiled in our controversy like this. But we've run out of Can-D. We either have to restock or switch. This is the critical moment. Of course, the Can-D pusher, Impy White, is after us to reorder through her. By the end of tonight, we'll have decided one way or another. And it will affect all of us for the rest of our lives.
So be glad you didn't arrive tomorrow, Fran said, after the vote is taken.
She smiled at him encouragingly, trying to make him feel welcome. They had little to offer him except their mutual bond, the fact of their relatedness one to another, and this was extended now to him.
What a place, Barney Meyerson was thinking to himself. The rest of my life.
It seemed impossible, but what they said was true. There was no provision in the UN Selective Service Law for mustering out, and the fact was not an easy one to face. These people were the body corporate for him now, and yet, how much worse it could be. Two of their women seemed physically attractive, and he could tell, or believed he could, that they were, so to speak, interested. He sensed the subtle interaction of the manifold complexities of the interpersonal relationships which built up in the cramped confines of a single hovel. But
the way out, Mary Regan said quietly to him, seating herself on the side of the bench opposite Todd Morris, is through one or the other of the translating drugs, Mr. Meyerson. Otherwise, as you can see, she put her hand on his shoulder. The physical touch was there already. It would be impossible. We'd simply wind up killing one another in our pain.
Yes, he said. I see.
But he had not learned that by coming to Mars. He had, like every other Terran, known that early in life, heard of colony life, the struggle against the lure of internecine termination to it all in one swift surrender. No wonder induction was fought so rabidly as had been the case with him originally. It was a fight to hold on to life.
Tonight, Mary Regan said to him, we'll procure one drug or the other. Impy will be stopping by about 7 p.m. Feinberg Crescent time. The answer will have to be in by then.
I think we can vote now, Norm Shine said.
I can see that Mr. Meyerson, even though he's just arrived, is prepared. Am I right, Meyerson?
Yes, Barney said.
The sand dredge had completed its autonomic task. His possessions sat in a meager heap, and loose sand billowed across them already. If they were not taken below, they would succumb to the dust, and soon. Hell, he thought, maybe it's just as well. Ties to the past.
The other hovelists gathered to assist him, passing his suitcases from hand to hand to the conveyor belt that serviced the hovel below the surface. Even if he was not interested in preserving his former goods, they were. They had a knowledge superior to his.
You learn to get by from day to day, Sam Regan said sympathetically to him. You never think in longer terms, just until dinner or until time for bed. Very finite intervals and tasks and pleasures. Escapes.
Tossing his cigarette away, Barney reached for the heaviest of his suitcases.
Thanks.
It was profound advice.
Excuse me, Sam Regan said with polite dignity and went to pick up the discarded cigarette for himself.
Seated in the hovel chamber, adequate to receive them all, the collective members, including new Barney Meyerson, prepared to solemnly vote. The time, 6 o'clock, Feinberg Crescent reckoning. The evening meal, shared as was customary, was over. The dishes now lay lathered and rinsed in the proper machine. No one, it appeared to Barney, had anything to do now. The weight of empty time hung over them all. Examining the collection of votes, Norm Schein announced,
4 for Choosy, 3 for Candy. That's the decision, then. Okay, who wants the job of telling Impy White the bad news?
He peered around at each of them.
She's going to be sore. We better expect that.
Barney said, I'll tell her. Astonished, the three couples who comprised the hovel's inhabitants, in addition to himself, stared at him.
But you don't even know her. Franchine protested.
I'll say it's my fault, Barney said, that I tipped the balance here to choose E.
They would let him, he knew. It was an onerous task. Half an hour later, he lounged in the silent darkness at the lip of the hovel's entrance, smoking and listening to the unfamiliar sounds of the Martian night. Far off, some lunary object streaked the sky, passing between his sight and the stars. A moment later, he heard retrojets. Soon, he knew. He waited, arms folded, more or less relaxed, practicing what he intended to say. Presently, a squat female figure dressed in heavy coveralls trudged into view.
Shine? Morris? Well, Regan, then?
She squinted at him using an infrared lantern.
I don't know you.
Warily, she halted.
I have a laser pistol.
It manifested itself, pointed at him.
Speak up!
Barney said, let's move out of earshot of the hovel. With extreme caution, impatience, White accompanied him, still pointing the laser pistol menacingly. She accepted his ident pack, reading it by means of her lantern.
You were with Bolero, she said,
glancing up at him appraisingly.
So?
So, he said. We're switching to Choosy, we at Chickenpox Prospects.
Why?
Just accept it, and don't push any farther here. You can check with Leo at PP, or through Connor Freeman on Venus.
I will, Impatience said. Choosy is garbage. It's habit-forming, toxic, and what's worse, leads to lethal escape dreams. Not of Terra, but of...
She gestured with a pistol.
Grotesque... Baroque fantasies of an infantile, totally deranged nature. Explain to me why this decision.
He said nothing. He merely shrugged. It was interesting, however, the ideological devotion on her part. It amused him. In fact, he reflected, its fanaticism was in sharp contrast to the attitude which the girl missionary aboard the Terra Mars ship had shown. Evidently, subject matter had no bearing. He had never realized this before.
I'll see you tomorrow night at this same time, Impatience White decided. If you're being truthful, fine. But if you're not...
What if I'm not? He said slowly, deliberately.
Can you force us to consume your product? After all, it is illegal. We could ask for UN protection.
You're new.
Her scorn was enormous. The UN in this region is perfectly aware of the Candide traffic. I pay a regular stipend to them to avoid interference. As far as Choosy goes, she gestured with her gun, if the UN is going to protect them and they're the coming thing, then you'll go over to them, Barney said. She did not answer. Instead, she turned and strode off. Almost at once, her short shape vanished into the Martian night. He remained where he was, and then he made his way back to the hovel, orienting himself by the looming, opaque shape of a huge, apparently discarded, tractor-type farm machine parked close by. Well, Norm Shine, to his surprise, said, meeting him at the entrance, I came up to see how many holes she had lasered in your cranium. She took it philosophically. Impy White? Norm laughed sharply. It's a million-skin business she runs. Philosophically, my ass. What really happened? Barney said, she'll be back after she gets instructions from above. He began to descend into the hovel. Yeah, that makes sense. She's small fry. Leo Bolero on Terra. I know. He saw no reason to conceal his previous career. In any case, it was public record. The hovelists would run across the datum eventually. I was Leo's pre-fash consultant for New York.
And you voted to switch to Choosy?
Norm was incredulous.
You had a falling out with Bolero, is that right?
I'll tell you sometime. He reached the bottom of the ramp and stepped out into the communal chamber where the others waited. With relief, Fran Shine said, at least she didn't stew you with that little laser pistol she waves around. You must have outstared her.
Are we rid of her? Todd Morris asked.
I'll have that news tomorrow night, Barney said. Mary Regan said to him, we think you're very brave. You're going to give this hovel a great deal, Mr. Meyerson. Barney, I mean. To mix a metaphor, a good swift goose to our morale.
My, my, Helen Morris mocked.
Aren't we getting a little inelegant in our dithering attempt to impress the new citizen?
Flushing, Mary Regan said,
I wasn't trying to impress him.
Flatter him, then, Fran Shine said softly.
You too, Mary said with anger. You were the first to fawn over him when he stepped off that ramp, or anyhow you wanted to. You would have if we hadn't all been here, if your husband especially hadn't been here.
To change the subject, Norm Shine said, too bad we can't translate ourselves tonight. Get out the good old Perky Pat layout one final time. Barney might enjoy it. He could at least see what he's voted to give up. Meaningfully, he gazed from one of them to the next, pinning each down.
Now come on, surely one of you has some candy you've held back, stuffed in a crack in the wall or under the septic tank for a rainy year.
Ah, come on, be generous to the new citizen. Show him you're not...
Okay, Helen Morris burst in, flushed with sullen resentment.
I have a little, enough for 3/4 of an hour, but that's absolutely all. And suppose that Choosy isn't ready for distribution in our area yet.
Get your candy, Norm said. As she departed, he said, and don't worry, Choosy is here. Today, when I was picking up a sack of salt from that last UN drop, I ran into one of their pushers. He gave me his card. He displayed the card. All we need to do is light a common strontium nitrate flare at 7:30 p.m., and they'll be down from their satellite.
Satellite!
Everyone squawked in amazement.
Then, Fran said excitedly, it must be UN sanctioned. Or do they have a layout, and the disc jockeys on the satellite advertise their new mins?
I don't know yet, Norm admitted. I mean, at this point, there's a lot of confusion. Wait till the dust settles. Here on Mars, Sam Regan said hollowly, it'll never settle. They sat in a circle. Before them, the Perky Pat layout, complete and elaborate, beckoned. They all felt its pull, and Norm Shine reflected that this was a sentimental occasion, because they would never be doing this again, unless, of course, they did it, made use of the layout, with Choose E.
How would that work out, he wondered.
Interesting. He had a feeling, unaccountably, that it would not be the same. And they might not like the difference.
You understand, Sam Regan said to the new member Barney Meyerson, that we're going to spend the translated period listening to and watching Pat's new Great Books animator. You know, the device they've just brought out on Terra. You're surely more familiar with it than we are, Barney, so maybe you ought to explain it to us.
Barney dutifully said, you insert one of the great books, for instance, Moby Dick, into the reservoir. Then you set the controls for long or short, then for funny version or same as book or sad version. Then you set the style indicator as to which classic great artist you want the book animated like. Dali, Bacon, Picasso, the medium-priced great books animator is set up to render in cartoon form the styles of a dozen system-famous artists. You specify which ones you want when you originally buy the thing. And there are options you can add later that provide even more.
Terrific, Norm Schein said, radiating enthusiasm. So what you get is a whole evening's entertainment. Say, sad version in the style of Jack Wright of, like, for instance, Vanity Fair. Wow!
Sighing, Fran said dreamily, how it must have resounded in your soul, Barney, to have lived so recently on Terra. You seem to carry the vibrations with you still.
Heck, we get it all, Norm said, when we're translated.
Impatiently, he reached for the undersized supply of candy.
Let's start.
Taking his own slice, he chewed with vigor.
The great book I'm going to turn into a full-length, funny cartoon version in the style of De Chirico will be...
He pondered. The Meditations of Marcus Aurelius.
Very witty, Helen Morris said cuttingly. I was going to suggest Augustine's Confessions in the style of Lichtenstein. Funny, of course.
I mean it.
Imagine, the surrealistic perspective. Deserted, ruined buildings with Doric columns lying on their sides. Hollow heads. Everybody else better get chewing, Fran advised, taking her slice, so we'll be in sync.
Barney accepted his.
The end of the old, he reflected as he chewed. I'm participating in what, for this particular hovel, is the final night, and in its place comes what?
If Leo is right, it will be intolerably worse. In fact, no comparison.
Of course, Leo is scarcely disinterested, but he is evolved and wise. Nind objects, which in the past I judged favorably, he realized.
I'll in a moment be immersed in a world composed of them, reduced to their dimension. And unlike the other hovelists, I can compare my experience of this layout with what I so recently left behind.
And fairly soon, he realized soberly, I will be required to do the same with Choose E.
You're going to discover it's an odd sensation, Norm Schein said to him, to find yourself inhabiting a body with three other fellas. We all have to agree on what we want the body to do, or anyhow a dominant majority has to form, otherwise we're just plain stuck.
That happens, Todd Morris said, half the time, in fact.
One by one, the rest of them began to chew their slices of candy. Barney Meyerson was the last and most reluctant.
Ah, hell, he thought all at once, and strode across the room to a basin. There, he spat out the half-chewed candy without having swallowed it.
The others, seated at the Perky Pat layout, had already collapsed into a coma, and none of them now paid any attention to him. He was, for all intents and purposes, suddenly alone. The hovel, for a time, was his. He wandered about, aware of the silence.
I just can't do it, he realized. Can't take the damn stuff like the rest of them do.
At least not yet.
A bell sounded. Someone was at the hovel entrance, requesting permission to enter. It was up to him to admit them. So he made his way, in ascent, hoping he was doing the proper thing, hoping that it was not one of the UN's periodic raids. There would not be much he could do to keep them from discovering the other hovelists inert at their layout and flagrante delicto, candy users. Lantern in hand, at the ground-level entrance, stood a young woman wearing a bulky heat-retention suit and clearly unaccustomed to it. She looked enormously uncomfortable.
"Hello, Mr. Meyerson," she said. "Remember me? I tracked you down because I'm just terribly lonely. May I come in?"
It was Ann Hawthorne. Surprised, he stared at her.
"Or are you busy? I could come back another time."
She half turned, starting away.
"I can see," he said, "that Mars has been quite some shock to you."
"It's a sin on my part," Anne said, "but I already hate it. I really do. I know I should adopt a patient attitude of acceptance and all that, but..."
She flashed the lantern at the landscape beyond the hovel, and in a quavering, despairing voice said,
"All I want to do now is find some way to get back to Earth. I don't want to convert anybody or change anything. I just want to get away from here."
She added morosely,
"But I know I can't. So I thought instead I'd visit you. See?"
Taking her by the hand, he led her down the ramp into the compartment which had been assigned to him as his living quarters.
"Where are your co-hovelists?"
She looked about alertly. "Out."
"Outside?"
She opened the door to the communal room and saw the lot of them slumped at the layout.
"Oh, out that way.
But not you." She shut the door, frowning, obviously perplexed.
"You amaze me. I'd have gladly accepted some candy tonight, the way I feel. Look how well you're standing up under it compared with me. I'm so inadequate."
Barney said, "Maybe I have more of a purpose here than you."
"I had plenty of purpose."
She removed her bulky suit and seated herself as he began fixing coffee for the two of them. "The people in my hovel, it's half a mile to the north of this one, are out too, the same way. Did you know I was so close? Would you have looked me up?" "Sure I would have." He found plastic, insipidly styled cups and saucers, laid them on the foldaway table, and produced the equally foldaway chairs. "Maybe," he said, "God doesn't extend as far as Mars. Maybe when we left Terra..."
"Nonsense,"
Anne said sharply, rousing herself. "I thought that would succeed in getting you angry."
"Of course it does. He's everywhere, even here."
She glanced at his partially unpacked possessions, the suitcases and sealed cartons.
"You didn't bring very much, did you?
Most of mine still on the way, on an autonomic transport." Strolling over, she stood, studying a pile of paperback books.
"De Imitatione Christi," she said in amazement.
"You're reading Thomas A. Kempis? This is a great and wonderful book."
"I bought it," he said, "but never read it."
"Did you try? I bet you didn't."
She opened it at random and read to herself, her lips moving. "Think the least gift that he giveth is great, and the most despisable things take as special gifts and as great tokens of love." "That would include life here on Mars, wouldn't it? This despisable life, shut up in these hovels. Well named, aren't they? Why in the name of God..." She turned to him, appealing to him. "Couldn't it be a finite period here, and then we could go home?" Barney said, "A colony, by definition, has to be permanent. Think of Roanoke Island."
"Yes," Anne nodded, "I have been. I wish Mars was one big Roanoke Island with everyone going home
to be slowly cooked.
We can evolve as the rich do. It could be done on a mass basis."
She put down the A Kempis book abruptly. "But I don't want that either, a chitinous shell and the rest. Isn't there any answer, Mr. Meyerson?
You know, Neo-Christians are taught to believe they're travelers in a foreign land, wayfaring strangers. Now we really are. Earth is ceasing to become our natural world, and certainly this never will be. We've got no world left."
She stared at him, her nostrils flaring.
"No home at all."
"Well," he said uncomfortably, "there's always candy and choosy."
"You have any?"
"No." She nodded.
"Back to Thomas A. Kempis, then."
But she did not pick the book up again. Instead, she stood head down, lost in dreary meditation.
"I know what's going to happen, Mr. Meyerson. Barney. I'm not going to convert anyone to Neo-American Christianity. Instead, they'll convert me to candy and choosy and whatever other vice is current here, whatever escape presents itself. Sex. They're terribly promiscuous here on Mars, you know. Everyone goes to bed with everyone else. I'll even try that. In fact, I'm ready for it right now. I just can't stand the way things are. Did you get a really good look at the surface before nightfall? Yes. It hadn't upset him that much, seeing the half-abandoned gardens and fully abandoned equipment, the great heaps of rotting supplies. He knew from edutapes that the frontier was always like that, even on Earth. Alaska had been like that until recent times, and so, except for the actual resort towns, was Antarctica right now. Ann Hawthorne said, "Those hovelists in the other room at their layout. Suppose we lifted Perky Pat entirely from the board and smashed it to bits. What would become of them?" They'd go on with their fantasy. It was established now. The props were no longer necessary as foci. Why would you want to do that? It had a decided sadistic quality to it, and he was surprised. The girl had not struck him that way at first meeting. "Iconoclasm," Anne said. "I want to smash their idols, and that's what Perky Pat and Walt are. I want to because I..." She was silent then. "I envy them. It's not religious fervor, it's just a very mean, cruel streak. I know it. If I can't join them..." "You can. You will. So will I. But not right away." He served her a cup of coffee. She accepted it reflexively, slender now without her heavy outer coat. She was, he saw, almost as tall as he. In heels she would be, if not taller. Her nose was odd. It ended in an ear ball, not quite humorously, but rather earthy, he decided, as if it ties her to the soil. It made him think of Anglo-Saxon and Norman peasants tilling their square, small fields. No wonder she hated it on Mars. Historically, her people undoubtedly had loved the authentic ground of Terra, the smell and actual texture, and above all, the memory it contained, the remnants in transmuted form of the host of critters who had walked about and then at last dropped dead, in the end perished and turned back not to dust, but to rich humus. Well, she could start a garden here on Mars. Maybe she could make one grow where previous hovelists had pointedly failed. How strange that she was so absolutely depressed. Was this normal for new arrivals? Somehow, he himself did not feel it. Perhaps on some deep level he imagined he would find his way back to Terra, in which case it was he who was deranged, not Anne. Anne said suddenly, "I have some candy, Barney." She reached into the pockets of her UN-issue canvas work slacks, groped, and brought a small packet out. "I bought it a little while ago in my own hovel. Black's back spit, as they call it. The hovelist who sold it to me believed that choosy would make it worthless, so he gave me a good price. I tried to take it. I practically had it in my mouth. But finally, like you, I couldn't. Isn't a miserable reality better than the most interesting illusion? Or is it illusion, Barney? I don't know anything about philosophy. You explain it to me, because all I know is religious faith, and that doesn't equip me to understand this, these translation drugs." All at once, she opened the packet. Her fingers squirmed desperately. "I can't go on, Barney." "Wait," he said, putting his own cup down and starting toward her. But it was too late. She had already taken the candy. "None for me?" he asked, a little amused. "You're missing the whole point. You won't have anyone to be with in translation." Taking her by the arm, he led her from the compartment, tugging her hurriedly out into the corridor and across into the large communal room where the others lay. Seating her among them, he said with compassion, "At least this way it'll be a shared experience, and I understand that helps." "Thank you," she said drowsily. Her eyes shut, and her body became by degrees limp. Now he realized she's Perky Pat, in a world without trouble. Bending, he kissed her on the mouth. I'm still awake, she murmured. But you won't remember anyhow, he said.
Oh, yes, I will,
Anne Hawthorne said faintly. And then she departed. He felt her go. He was alone with 7 uninhabited physical shells, and he at once made his way back to his own quarters where the 2 cups of hot coffee steamed. I could fall in love with that girl, he said to himself. Not like Ronnie Fugate, or even like Emily, but something new.
Better, he wondered.
Or is this desperation? Exactly what I saw Anne do just now with a candy, gulp it down because there is nothing else, only darkness. It is this or the void. And not for a day or a week, but forever. So I've got to fall in love with her. By himself, he sat surrounded by his partly unpacked belongings, drinking coffee and meditating until at last he heard groanings and stirrings in the communal room. His fellow hovelists were returning to consciousness. He put his cup down and walked out to join them.
Why'd you back out, Meyerson? Norm Schein said.
He rubbed his forehead, scowling.
God, what a headache I've got.
He noticed Anne Hawthorne then, still unconscious. She lay with her back against the wall, her head dropped forward.
Who's she?
Fran, rising to her feet unsteadily, said,
She joined us at the end. She's a pal of Meyerson's. He met her on the flight. She's quite nice, but she's a religious nut, you'll see.
Critically, she eyed Anne.
Not too bad looking. I was really curious to see her. I imagined her as more, well, austere.
Coming up to Barney, Sam Regan said,
Get her to join you, Meyerson. We'd be glad to vote to admit her here. We've got lots of room, and you should have a, shall we say, wife.
He, too, scrutinized Anne.
Yeah, he said. Pretty. Nice, long, black hair. I like that.
You do you? Mary Regan said tartly to him.
Yeah, I do. So what?
Sam Regan glared back at his wife. Barney said, She's spoken for. They all eyed him curiously.
That's odd, Helen Morris said, because when we were together with her just now, she didn't tell us that. And as far as we could make out, you and she had only...
Interrupting, Fran Schein said to Barney,
You don't want a neo-Christian nut to live with you.
You've had experience with that. We ejected a couple of them last year. They can cause terrible trouble here on Mars.
Remember, we shared her mind. She's a dedicated member of some high church or other with all the sacraments and the rituals, all that old, outdated junk. She actually believes in it.
Barney said tightly, I know.
In an easygoing way, Todd Morris said, That's true, Meyerson. Honest. We have to live too close together to import any kind of ideological fanaticism from Terra. It's happened at other hovels. We know what we're talking about. It has to be live and let live, with no absolutist creeds and dogma. The hovel is just too small.
He lit a cigarette and glanced down at Anna Hawthorne.
Strange that a pretty girl would pick that stuff up. Well, it takes all kinds.
He looked puzzled.
Did she seem to enjoy being translated? Barney asked Helen Morris.
Yes, to a certain extent. Of course, it upset her. The first time you have to expect that. She didn't know how to cooperate in handling the body, but she was quite eager to learn. Now, obviously, she's got it all to herself, so it's easier on her. This is good practice. Bending down, Barney Meyerson picked up the small doll, Perky Pat in her yellow shorts and red-striped cotton T-shirt and sandals. This now was Anne Hawthorne, he realized, in a sense that no one quite understood. And yet, he could destroy the doll, crush it, and Anne, in her synthetic fantasy life, would be unaffected. I'd like to marry her, he said aloud, suddenly.
Who? Todd asked. Perky Pat or the new girl?
He means Perky Pat, Norm Schein said and snickered.
No, he doesn't, Helen said severely, and I think it's fine. Now we can be 4 couples instead of 3 couples and 1 man, 1 odd man.
Is there any way, Barney said, to get drunk around here?
Sure, Norm said. We've got liquor. It's dull ersatz gin, but it's 80 proof. It'll do the job. Let me have some, Barney said, reaching for his wallet. It's free. The UN supply ships drop it in vats. Norm went to a locked cupboard, produced a key, and opened it. Sam Regan said, Tell us, Morrison, why you feel the need to get drunk. Is it us? The hovel? Mars itself? No. It was none of those. It had to do with Anne and the disintegration of her identity. Her use of Can D all at once. A symptom of her inability to believe or to cope or giving up. It was an omen in which he, too, was involved. He saw himself in what had happened. If he could help her, perhaps he could help himself. And if not, he had an intuition that otherwise they were both finished. Mars, for both himself and Anne, would mean death, and probably soon. 9. After she emerged from the experience of translation, Anne Hawthorne was taciturn and moody. It was not a good sign. He guessed that she, too, now had a premonition similar to his. However, she said nothing about it. She merely went at once to get her bulky outer suit from his compartment. I have to get back to Flaxback Spit, she explained. Thank you for letting me use your layout, she said to the hovelists who stood here and there, watching her as she dressed. I'm sorry, Barney, she hung her head. It was unkind to leave you the way I did. He accompanied her, on foot, across the flat nocturnal sands to her own hovel. Neither of them spoke as they plodded along, keeping their eyes open, as they had been told to, for a local predator, a jackal-like telepathic Martian life form. However, they saw nothing. How was it? He asked her at last. You mean being that little brassy blonde-haired doll with all her damn clothes and her boyfriend and her car and her... Anne beside him shuddered. Awful. Well, that's not it. Just pointless. I found nothing there. It was like going back to my teens. Yeah, he agreed. There was that about Perky Pat. Barney, she said quietly, I have to find something else, and soon. Can you help me? You seem smart and grown up and experienced. Being translated is not going to help me. Choosy won't be any better because something in me rebels, won't take it, see? Yes, you see, I can tell. Hell, you wouldn't even try it once, so you must understand. She squeezed his arm and clung tightly to him in the darkness. I know something else, Barney. They're tired of it, too. All they did was bicker while we were inside those dolls. They didn't enjoy it for a second, even. Gosh, he said. Flashing her lantern ahead, Anne said, It's a shame. I wish they did. I feel sorrier for them than I do for... She ceased, walked on for a time in silence, and then abruptly said, I've changed, Barney. I feel it in myself. I want to sit down here, wherever we are. You and I alone in the dark. And then... You know what? I don't have to say, do I? No, he admitted. But the thing is, you'd regret it afterward. I would too, because of your reaction. Maybe I'll pray, Anne said. Praying is hard to do. You have to know how. You don't pray for yourself. You pray what we call an intercessive prayer for others. And what you pray to isn't the God who's in the heavens, out there somewhere. It's to the Holy Spirit within. That's different. That's the Paraclete. Did you ever read Paul? Paul who? In the New Testament. His letters to, for instance, the Corinthians or the Romans. You know. Paul says our enemy is death. It's the final enemy we overcome. So I guess it's the greatest. We're all blighted, according to Paul. Not just our bodies, but our souls, too. Both have to die. And then we can be born again, with new bodies, not of flesh, but incorruptible. See? You know, when I was Perky Pat just now, I had the oddest feeling that I was... It's wrong to say this or believe it, but... But, Barney finished for her, it seemed like a taste of that. But you expected it, though. You knew the resemblance.
You mentioned it yourself on the ship. A lot of people, he reflected, had noticed it too.
Yes, Anne admitted. But what I didn't realize is...
In the darkness, she turned toward him. He could just barely make her out.
Being translated is the only hint we can have of it, this side of death. So it's a temptation. If it wasn't for that dreadful doll, that perky Pat...
Choosy, Barney said.
That's what I was thinking.
If it was like that, like what Paul says about the corruptible man putting on incorruption...
I couldn't stop myself, Barney. I'd have to choose E. I wouldn't be able to wait until the end of my life. It might be 50 years living here on Mars, half a century.
She shuddered.
Why wait, when I could have it now?
The last person I talked to, Barney said, who had taken choose E, said it was the worst experience of his life. That startled her.
In what way?
He fell into the domain of someone or something he considered absolutely evil, someone he was terrified of. And he was lucky, and he knew it, to get away again.
Barney, she said, why are you on Mars?
Don't say it's because of the draft. A person as smart as you could have gone to a psychiatrist. I'm on Mars, he said, because I made a mistake. In your terminology, he reflected, it would be called a sin. And in my terminology, too, he decided. Anne said,
you hurt someone, didn't you?
He shrugged.
So now, for the rest of your life, you're here, Anne said.
Barney, can you get me a supply of choosy?
Pretty soon.
It would not be long before he ran into one of Palmer Eldridge's pushers. He was certain of that. Putting his hand on her shoulder, he said, but you can get it for yourself just as easily. She leaned against him as they walked, and he hugged her. She did not resist. In fact, she sighed with relief.
Barney,
I have something to show you. A leaflet that one of the people in my hovel gave me. She said a whole bundle had been dropped the other day. It's from the Choosy people. Reaching into her bulky coat, she rummaged about. Then, in the glare of the lantern, he saw the folded paper.
Read it. You'll understand why I feel as I do about Choosy. Why it's such a spiritual problem for me.
Holding the paper to the light, he read the top line. It blazed out in huge black letters, God promises eternal life. We can deliver it.
See? Anne said.
I see. He did not even bother to read the rest. Folding the paper back up, he returned it to her, feeling heavy-hearted. Quite a slogan.
A true one.
Not the big lie, Barney said, but instead, the big truth. Which, he wondered, is worse.
Hard to tell.
Ideally, Palmer Eldritch would drop dead for the blasphemia shouted by the pamphlet, but evidently that was not going to occur. An evil visitor oozing over us from the prox system, he said to himself, offering us what we've prayed for over a period of 2,000 years. And why is this so palpably bad? Hard to say, but nevertheless it is. Because maybe it'll mean bondage to Eldritch, such as Leo experienced. Eldritch will be with us constantly from now on, infiltrating our lives. And he who has protected us in the past simply sits passive. Each time we're translated, he thought, we'll see not God, but Palmer Eldritch. Aloud, he said, if Choosy fails you,
don't say that.
If Palmer Eldritch fails you, then maybe... He stopped. Because ahead of them lay the hovel, Flaxback Spit. Its entrance light glowed dimly in the Martian gloom. Your home. He did not like to let her go. His hand on her shoulder, he clung to her, thinking back to what he had said to his fellow hovelists about her. Come back with me, he said, to Chickenpox Prospects. We'll get formally, legally married. She stared at him, and then, incredibly, she began to laugh.
Does that mean no? He asked woodenly.
What, Anne said, is Chickenpox Prospects?
Oh, I see, that's the code name of your hovel. I'm sorry, Barney, I didn't mean to laugh. But the answer, of course, is no. She moved away from him and opened the outer door of the hovel's entrance chamber. And then she set down her lantern and stepped toward him, arms held out. "Make love to me," she said. "Not here, too close to the entrance." He was afraid. "Wherever you want. Take me there." She put her arms around his neck. "Now," she said. "Don't wait." He didn't. Taking her up in his arms, he carried her away from the entrance. "Dolly," she said, when he laid her down in the darkness. She gasped presently, perhaps from the sudden cold that spilled over them, penetrating their heavy suits, which no longer served, which in fact were a hindrance to true warmth. One of the laws of thermodynamics, he thought, the exchange of heat, molecules passing between us, hers and mine mingling in entropy. Not yet, he thought. "Oh, my," she said in the darkness. "I hurt you?" "No, I'm sorry, please." The cold numbed his back, his ears. It radiated down from the sky. He ignored it as best he could, but he thought of a blanket, a thick wool layer. Strange to be preoccupied with that at such a time. He dreamed of its softness, the scratch of its fibers against his skin, its heaviness. Instead of the brittle, frigid, thin air which made him pant in huge gulps as if finished. "Are you dying?" she asked. "Just can't breathe. This air."
Poor... Good Lord, I've forgotten your name.
Hell of a thing. Barney! He clutched her.
"No, don't stop."
She arched her back. Her teeth chattered. "I wasn't going to," he said.
"Oh, ah!"
He laughed.
"Don't please laugh at me."
Not meant unkindly. A long silence then. Then, oof! She leaped, galvanized, as if lost to the shock of a formal experiment. His pale, dignified, unclothed possession, become a tall and very thin, greenless, nervous system of a frog, probed to life by outside means, victim of a current not her own but not protested in any way. Lucid and real, accepting. Ready this long time. "You all right?"
"Yes," she said. "Yes, Barney, I certainly very much am. Yes!"
Later, as he tramped back alone, leadenly, in the direction of his own hovel, he said to himself, "Maybe I'm doing Palmer Eldritch's work. Breaking her down, demoralizing her, as if she weren't already. As if we all weren't." Something blocked his way. Halting, he located in his coat the sidearm which had been provided him. There were, especially at night, in addition to the fearsome telepathic jackal, vicious domestic organisms that stung and ate. He flashed his light warily, expecting some bizarre multi-armed contraption composed perhaps of slime. Instead, he saw a parked ship, the small swift type with slight mass, its tubes still smoked, so evidently it had just now landed. Must have coasted down, he realized, since he hadn't heard any retro noise. From the ship a man crept, shook himself, snapped on his own lantern, made out Barney Meyerson, and grunted, "I'm Alan Fane. I've been looking all over for you. Leo wants to keep in touch with you through me. I'll be telecasting in code to you at your hovel. Here's your code book." Fane held out a slender volume. "You know who I am, don't you?" "The disc jockey." Weird, this meeting here on the open Martian desert at night between himself and this man from the PP layout satellite. It seemed unreal. "Thanks," he said, accepting the code book. "What do I do, write it down as you say it and then sneak off to decode it?" "There'll be a private TV receiver in your compartment in the hovel. We've arranged for it on the grounds that, being new to Mars, you crave..." "Okay," Barney said, nodding. "So, you have a girl already," Fane said. "Pardon my use of the infrared searchlight, but I don't pardon it. You'll find that there's little privacy on Mars in matters of that nature. It's like a small town, and all the hovelists are starved for news, especially any kind of scandal. I ought to know. It's my job to keep in touch and pass on what I can.
Naturally, there's a lot I can't. Who's the girl? I don't know, Barney said sardonically. It was dark. I couldn't see. He started on then, going around the parked ship. Wait. You're supposed to know this. A Choose E pusher is already operating in the area, and we calculate that he'll be approaching your particular hovel as early as tomorrow morning, so be ready. Make sure you buy the bindle in front of witnesses. They should see the entire transaction, and then when you chew it, make sure they can clearly identify what you're consuming. Got it? Thane added, and try to draw the pusher out. Get him to give as complete a warranty verbally, of course, as you possibly can. Make him sell you on the product. Don't ask for it. See? Barney said, and what do I get for doing this? Pardon? Leo never at any time bothered to... I'll tell you what, Thane said quietly. We'll get you off Mars. That's your payment. After a time, Barney said, You mean it? It'll be illegal, of course. Only the UN can legally route you back to Terra, and that's not going to happen. What we'll do is pick you up some night and transfer you to Winnie the Pooh Acres. And there I'll stay. Until Leo's surgeons can give you a new face, finger and footprints, cephalic wave pattern, a new identity throughout. Then you'll emerge, probably at your old job for PP layouts. I understand you were their New York man. 2.5 years from now, you'll be at that again. So don't give up hope. Barney said, Maybe I don't want that. What? Sure you do. Every colonist wants. I'll think it over, Barney said, and let you know. But maybe I'll want something else. He was thinking about Anne. To go back to Terra and pick up once again, perhaps even with Ronnie Fugate, at some deep instinctive stratum, it did not have the appeal to him that he would have expected. Mars, or the experience of love with Anne Hawthorne, had even further altered him now. He wondered which it was. Both. And anyhow, he thought, I asked to come here. I wasn't really drafted. And I must never let myself forget that. Helen Thane said, I know some of the circumstances, Meyerson. What you're doing is atoning, correct? Surprised, Barney said, You too? Religious inclinations seem to permeate the entire milieu here. You may object to the word, Thane said, but it's the proper one. Listen, Meyerson, by the time we get you to Winnie the Pooh Acres, you'll have atoned sufficiently. There's something you don't know yet. Look at this. He held out, reluctantly, a small plastic tube, a container. Chilled, Barney said, What's this? Your illness. Leo believes, on professional advice, that it's not enough for you merely to state in court that you've been damaged. They'll insist on thoroughly examining you.
Tell me specifically what it is in this thing.
It's epilepsy, Meyerson, the Q form. The strain whose causes no one is sure of, whether it's due to organic injury that can't be detected with the EEG, or whether it's psychogenic. And the symptoms? Thane said, Grand mal. After a pause, he said, Sorry. I see, Barney said, and how long will I have them? We can administer the antidote after the litigation, but not before. A year at the most. So now you can see what I meant when I said that you're going to be in a position to more than atone for not bailing out Leo when he needed it. You can see how this illness, claimed as a side effect of Choose E, will... Sure, Barney said. Epilepsy is one of the great scare words, like cancer once. People are irrationally afraid of it because they know it can happen to them any time with no warning. Especially the more recent Q form. Hell, they don't even have a theory about it.
What's important is that with the Q form, no organic alteration of the brain is involved, and that means we can restore you.
The tube there. It's a metabolic toxin, similar in action to metrazole. Similar, but unlike metrazole, it continues to produce the attacks, with a characteristically deranged EEG pattern during those intervals, until it's neutralized, which, as I say, we're prepared to do. Won't a blood fraction test show the presence of this toxin? It will show the presence of a toxin, and that's exactly what we want, because we will sequester the documents pertaining to the physical and mental induction exams which you recently took, and we'll be able to prove that when you arrived on Mars, there was no Q-type epilepsy and no toxicity. And it'll be Leo's, or rather your, contention that the toxicity in the blood is a derivative of Chu-Z. Barney said, even if I lose the suit, it will still greatly damage Chu-Z's sales. Most colonists have a nagging feeling anyhow that the translation drugs are in the long run biochemically harmful. Thane added, the toxin in that tube is relatively rare. Leo obtained it through highly specialized channels. It originates on Io, I believe. One certain doctor, Willie Dankmal, Barney said. Thane shrugged. Possibly. In any case, there it is in your hand. As soon as you've been exposed to Chu-Z, you're to take it.
Try to have your first Grand Mal attack where your fellow hovelists will see you. Don't be off somewhere on the desert farming or bossing autonomic dredges. As soon as you've recovered from the attack, get on the vidphone and ask the UN for medical assistance. Have their disinterested doctors examine you. Don't apply for private medication. It would probably be a good idea, Barney said, if the UN doctors could run an EEG on me during an attack. Absolutely. So try, if possible, to get yourself into a UN hospital. In all, there are three on Mars. You'll be able to put forward a good argument for this because, Thane hesitated, frankly, with this toxin, your attacks will involve severe destructiveness toward yourself and to others. Technically, they'll be of the hysterical, aggressive variety, concluding in a more or less complete loss of consciousness. It'll be obvious what it is right from the start because, or so I'm told, you'll reveal the typical tonic stage, with great muscular contractions, and then the clonic stage of rhythmic contraction alternating with relaxation, after which, of course, the coma supervenes. In other words, Barney said, the classic convulsive form. Does it frighten you? I don't see where that matters. I owe Leo something. You and I and Leo know that. I still resent the word atonement, but I suppose this is that. He wondered how this artificially induced illness would affect his relationship with Anne. Probably this would terminate the thing. So he was giving up a good deal for Leo Bolero. But then Leo was doing something for him, too. Getting him off Mars was no minor consideration. We're taking it for granted, Thane said, that they'll make an attempt to kill you the moment you retain an attorney. In fact, they'll... I'd like to go back to my hovel now. He moved off, okay? Fine. Go pick up the routine there. But let me give you a word of advice as regards that girl. Doberman's Law. Remember, he was the first person to marry and then get divorced on Mars? States that in proportion to your emotional attachment to someone on this damn place, the relationship deteriorates. I'd give you 2 weeks at the most, and not because you'll be ill, but because that's standard. Martian musical chairs. And the UN encourages it because it means, frankly, if I may say so, more children to populate the colony. Catch? The UN, Barney said, might not sanction my relationship with her because it's on a somewhat different basis than you're describing. No, it's not, Thane said calmly. It may seem so to you, but I watch the whole planet day in, night out. I'm just stating a fact. I'm not being critical. In fact, I'm personally sympathetic. Thanks, Barney said and walked away, flashing his light ahead of him in the direction of his hovel. Tied about his throat the small bleeper signal which told him when he was nearing, and more important, when he was not nearing, his hovel began to sound louder, a one-frog pond of comfort close to his ear. I'll take the toxin, he said to himself,
and I'll go into court and sue the bastards for Leo's sake, because I owe that to him. But I'm not returning to Earth. Either I make it here or not at all. With Anne Hawthorne, I hope, but if not, then alone, or with someone else. I'll live out Doberman's law, as Fane predicts. Anyhow, it'll be here on this miserable planet, this promised land. Tomorrow morning, he decided, I'll begin clearing away the sand of 50,000 centuries for my first vegetable garden. That's the initial step. 10. Next day, both Norm Shine and Todd Morris spent the early hours with him, teaching him the knack of operating the bulldozers and dredges and scoops which had fallen into various stages of ruin. Most of the equipment, like old tomcats, could be coaxed into one more effort. But the results did not amount to much. They had been discarded for too long. By noon he was exhausted, so he treated himself to a break, resting in the shade of a mammoth, rusty tractor, eating a cold rations lunch and drinking tepid tea from a thermos which Fran Shine had been kind enough to bring up to him. Below in the hovel, the others did whatever it was they customarily did. He didn't care. On all sides of him, their abandoned, decaying gardens could be seen, and he wondered if soon he would forget his, too. Maybe each new colonist had started out this way, in an agony of effort, and then the torpor, the hopelessness, claimed them. And yet, was it so hopeless? Not really. It's an attitude, he decided, and we, all of us who comprised PP layouts, contributed willingly to it. We gave them an out, something painless and easy. And now Palmer Eldritch has arrived to put the finish on the process. We laid the path for him, myself included, and so what now? Is there any way that I can, as Fane put it, atone? Approaching him, Helen Morris called cheerfully, "How's the farming coming?" She dropped down beside him and opened a fat seed catalog with the UN stamp plainly marked throughout. "Observe what they'll provide free. Every seed known to thrive here, including turnips." Resting against him, she turned the pages. "However, there's a little mouse-like burrowing mammal that shows up on the surface late at night. Be prepared for that. It eats everything. You'll have to set out a few self-propelling traps." "Okay," Barney said. "It's quite some sight, one of those homeostatic traps taking off across the sand in pursuit of a marsel mouse." "God, they go fast. Both the mouse and the trap. You can make it more interesting by placing a bet. I usually bet on the trap. I admire them."
"I think I'd probably bet on the trap, too." "I've got a great respect for traps," he reflected. "In other words, a situation in which none of the doors lead out, no matter how they happen to be marked."
Helen said, "Also, the UN will supply 2 robots free of charge for your use, for a period not to exceed 6 months. So better plan ahead wisely as to how you want to employ them. The best is to set them to work constructing irrigation ditches. Ours is mostly no good now. Sometimes the ditches have to run 200 miles, even more. Or you can hatch out a deal."
"No deals," Barney said.
"But these are good deals. Find someone nearby in one of the other hovels who started his own irrigation system and then abandoned it. Buy it from him and tap it. Is your girl at Flaxback Spit going to come over here and join you?"
She eyed him.
He did not answer. He watched, in the black Martian sky with its noontime stars, a circling ship. The Choosy Man? The time then had come for him to poison himself so that an economic monopoly could be kept alive, a sprawling interplan empire from which he now derived nothing. Amazing, he thought, how strong the self-destructive drive can be. Helen Morris, straining to see, said,
"Visitors, it's not a UN ship either."
She started toward the hovel at once. "I'll go tell them." With his left hand, he reached into his coat and touched the tube deep in the interior pocket, thinking to himself, "Can I actually do this?" It didn't seem possible.
There was nothing in his makeup historically which would explain it. Maybe, he thought, it's from despair at having lost everything. But he didn't think so. It was something else. As the ship landed on the flat desert not far off, he thought, maybe it's to reveal something to Anne about Chu Zi, even if the demonstration is faked. Because he thought, if I accept the toxin into my system, she won't try Chu Zi. He had a strong intuition of that. And it was enough. From the ship stepped Palmer Eldritch. No one could fail to identify him, since his crash on Pluto, the homeopapes had printed one pic after another. Of course, the pics were 10 years out of date, but this was still the man. Gray and bony, well over 6 feet tall, with swinging arms and a peculiarly rapid gait. And his face, it had a ravaged quality, eaten away, as if, Barney conjectured, the fat layer had been consumed, as if Eldritch at some time or other had fed off himself, devoured perhaps with gusto these superfluous portions of his own body. He had enormous steel teeth, these having been installed prior to his trip to Prox by Czech dental surgeons. They were welded to his jaws, were permanent. He would die with them. And his right arm was artificial. End of side 4. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.